From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. And this morning we talk with Renee Huang of Wild Women Tribe, who talk about the various modalities of self-growth, from hiking and journal writing to shamanic energy, breath work, and even working with equine-assisted learning. It's all included in a September retreat in Oakley.
And then we speak with author and novelist David Robleski. He will come to the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City tomorrow. That's Thursday, the 1st of August. David is the number one best-selling author of the book, The Story of Edgar Sawtelle. And he joins us to talk about his new book, Familiaris. It captures the way humans and canines form inseparable bonds and about the fragility of humanity. These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Wild Women Tribe of Park City is putting on a homegrown retreat in September. It features an all-star team of five local facilitators sharing different perspectives and modalities, from guided journal writing to shamanic energy to breathwork, yoga, and visualization, and even something that involves horses, equine-assisted learning. Coming with us now to tell us more is the founder of Wild Woman Tribe, Renee Huang.
Hi there. Yes.
I was so excited to hear about this because I know you do these in lots of places around the world. So to have one so close was really sounds like a treat for people. Where, tell us about where it's going to be.
So it's actually at a ranch in Oakley. It's a ranch that is owned by Chris Getzey and her husband, Rob, and they are in the community. And Chris is a horsewoman. She's been won her entire life. And so it's really quite fortunate that we're able to host here locally with a team of local facilitators.
Oh, I bet even though it's close, I bet it feels a million miles away.
Well, that's the thing about these retreats. They end up being their own little bubbles where time kind of stands still because you're attracting in people who are at this place in their lives where they want to call in change and they're ready for a reset. And so people drop in really quickly. We put our phones aside. It's not a requirement, but you end up moving through these days and it feels more like months or weeks.
I bet. I'm so curious because in reading about it, it seems like the transformation is a big theme on this retreat. What kind of transformation have you seen women move through on former retreats?
That's a great question. And I feel like that word transformation can seem really scary to people because it might signify like, oh, leaving behind things and becoming something that you're not. You know, we think of the analogy of like the caterpillar turning to goo inside of the cocoon and coming out as a butterfly. And it doesn't have to be like that. And it certainly is not most of the time like that. It's more subtle. It's very internal. You know, from the outward appearance, like you can look at someone who has quote unquote gone through transformation and not see anything, but it's more of her relationship with herself and the way that she approaches her life and her outlook. So I feel like transformation is something that we all go through. I mean, life is full of transformations over and over and over again. And in this retreat setting, it's meant to be a very internal process that is so personal to the individual. And so whatever it means to that person coming in, like, oh, I'd like to learn more tools of self-care, or I want to have a better relationship with my self-esteem, or I feel so busy, I feel constantly like I'm putting myself in the back burner. How do I transform my own outlook so that I can manage my life with more ease and more tools rather than from a place of anxiety and stress. So the transformation, I think, in this setting is really quite catered toward whatever it is that you want to call in.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Renee Huang. She's the founder of Wild Women Tribe. And Renee, let's go back. We've talked to you for a lot of years since the beginning of Wild Women Tribe. And has it been about 10 years or so?
No, not quite. See, you're in the transformation vortex already, Lynn. It's been like, I think it's been six.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And let's talk about, you know, when you founded it, why you did, and how it has transformed and changed along the way, or still stayed within sort of what you imagined when you created this whole program.
Yeah, thank you. I felt so fortunate to be able to sit down with you kind of on a yearly check-in basis over the years. So it's been really fun to ride that wave with you. And wow, gosh, like when I first created Wild Women Tribe like 6 years ago, it was from a place of my own kind of discomfort and being in a place where I didn't know what was next. And I was going through my own period of uncertainty and wanting just to have more relationships of depth with women, and wanting to kind of curate these spaces in the outdoors, because we're so lucky to live here in Park City. I mean, I stepped away a little bit this summer and came back and thought, I am so happy to be home. You know, this place is quite exceptional. We live in such a fortunate community and to be surrounded by the outdoors. And so the outdoors was always part of my attraction point and feeling like I feel like myself when I'm on a hiking trail or in the middle of the trees on a ski trail. And so that was the original inception point, you know, my own seeking and then wanting to have nature be a foundation for this type of expansion with other women.
Whenever we talk to you, Renee, I think that I feel like you really bring something that might feel very ethereal or high on the groovy meter, down to these words that everyone can relate to. And perhaps it comes, you sort of had a corporate background or professional background in doing something not even like this in your other life. And maybe that helps you sort of integrate the two worlds. And to a certain degree, that's what we have to look at it as, you know, if we're not constantly in a, you know, shamanic retreat or constantly doing energy work or breath work or yoga or whatever it is, you know, we come from a different orientation. How do you kind of bring the two together?
Yeah, I feel like I relate to that really profoundly, that idea of integration and, you know, bringing kind of a practical side to whatever that perception might be of something being woo-woo or out there, or, you know, energy work, it's so inaccessible. Like it's about really knowing yourself on a deeper level, whatever that may be, without the label. And so I think what I see is an invitation for people to explore themselves without so much of the outward influence. You know, we're told to be a certain way, or we kind of mold ourselves into the shape of the community and, you know, the friend group and the other outward influences. And so I feel like for myself, the journey has been more about going inward and really returning to my own roots. And, you know, I jokingly call it rewilding. You know, it's like, oh, coming back to my own interests, what I feel like I can learn from in the world, and really what the internal guidance system is that I have, that I think like being in the corporate world or being so attached to outward perceptions and validations, that can really separate us from what it is that we really know inside ourselves. And so for me, it's been this coming home to learning these different tools and modalities, and some of them are woo-woo and some of them, you know, I had my judgments about. And once I started opening my mind to explorations, I realized that my judgment came from a place of fear and not knowing and kind of skepticism and like a little bit of scarcity, you know, like, oh, well, that's not for me. I don't even know what that is, you know? So once I started opening my mind and realizing there's so much more to life and to learning and knowledge and wisdom than what we can see and what we've told ourselves and trained ourselves. I feel like that is a perspective that can really change people's lives. It changed my life for sure. And you asked earlier, you know, what I've seen in the growth of the group. And I would say it's more women who are in these typical quote unquote corporate backgrounds or in, you know, these high powered, high functioning positions, realizing there's more to me. And so I've seen way more like C-suite women, like women who are running businesses, women who you would traditionally not think of as like someone who would walk barefoot on the earth or, you know, do breath work or whatever the label might be. I've seen way more step in and be like, you know what? I feel like there's more to my own self-regulation than I've given myself credit for. This doesn't feel great to function in, you know, a super structured lifestyle anymore. I want to learn myself more. And so that's, I think, what I've related to over the years and what I've seen in women around me and just in the community.
Well, it sure seems like there are a lot of cool activities, and that maybe I can imagine the retreat meets you where you are. Maybe you've experienced or been curious about some of these things, and maybe other activities will be new to you. This is totally up my alley. I am very, very happy and comfortable in energy realms and creativity stuff, but I have not ever experienced equine therapy. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and so Alejandra Lara is a beautiful woman in our community. She's been here for, I don't know, 20, 25 years. She's originally from Chile, and her business is called Park City Horse Experience. And so she's got this trauma-informed therapy background working with these horses. And she grew up like in the mountains in Chile and, you know, rode before she could walk practically. And so we're really fortunate to have her curating these really soft, gentle, subtle workshops with the horses that don't involve riding. They're very much based on nonverbal communication, boundaries, consent with other beings. And so it's this work of like being with these five or six huge horses who aren't speaking English, you know, they're not communicating with us in the language that we know. And yet we're able to share such amazing, soft moments with them. And Alejandra talks about how horses have a heart that's five times the size of the human heart. And so they're able to feel with this huge capacity and hold space for people to arrive exactly as they are. And so it's these three sessions that we have over the course of the retreat where we go deeper and deeper and deeper kind of into our own knowing, learning how to kind of interface with other beings, not just the humans in our group, but also the horses, and then learning how to communicate and kind of appreciate their energetic thumbprint or how they show up and how we can receive them as well.
Wow, that's so interesting. Aside from the equine portion, could you maybe walk us through what a day on the retreat would look like?
Yeah, sure. There's one of the things I love about these retreats is the diversity of perspective and facilitators. And I feel like sometimes when you go on a retreat, you know, it's one, maybe two people who are kind of running the whole show. And so you do get a very distilled version of what their modalities or perspectives might be, which is amazing. And on these retreats, we have like five facilitators who bring in a breadth of knowledge and diversity that I think can inform and just give you a lot of ideas of where to go next in your own journey. So we'll have yoga and breath work in the morning. We're working with Jill Johnson, who a lot of people in our community might know from being the owner of the Paint Mixer, and she herself is an art therapist. And so I'm so excited to have her and her bubbly energy in this container.
I've known Jill for years. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And she recently, like last year, got certified as a yoga teacher. And so she's just bringing all of this kind of full circle. And so she'll be starting us off in the mornings, and then we have breakfast and pack up a lunch, and then we will be on the trails. So we'll be up in the Uintas on different trails, some of them with water nearby, and we'll be working with Marissa Zelenak, who is one of the lead facilitators at Shamanic Twist, which is another local, really well-beloved location in Camas, and that's owned by Danielle Bryan. And so Marissa is going to be leading these energy sessions where we learn about our own energy systems and how to tune into those in nature while we're on the trail. And then my background's in writing, and so I will be leading some workshops that involve the power of words. And so reframing thoughts and beliefs and limiting beliefs, and using journal writing prompts to actually replace them and kind of call in more of the life that we want to manifest.
Wow. And I want to go.
You definitely need to come. And then we'll be back at the ranch and spending 2 hours each day with the horses and with Alejandra. So yeah, that's the basic kind of format. And we have this cute little girl from Salt Lake who is a vegan chef. And so she'll be cooking in the kitchen and using like herbs and locally grown vegetables. And it's mainly vegetarian, and we'll have meat on the side. And so it's this experience of like moving through these different modalities while being nourished in nature, nourished by food and just the companionship of the women who are going to be there.
Wow, it sounds wonderful. We haven't even said when this is. September 18th through 22nd. Again, it's in Oakley, Utah, and it will be on the Saddleback Ranch. It's hosted by Chris Getze. That's her ranch, along with her husband. So some more kind of details around, you know, what the costs are, and I think we sort of know what that includes, but what's the lodging like?
So the lodging is at, they call it their Welcome Center, which really doesn't even encapsulate this beautiful home. It's like a 5-bedroom home, and each of the suites are masters. And so we have these shared spaces for the women. You can come in with a friend if you have someone in mind, but I mean, most people come quote unquote by themselves, you know, ready to meet their new best friend. And those shared suites start at $24.99. And then we also have, Chris has said, you know, oh, if someone wants to bring an RV or like a pop-up or set up a tent on the lawn, you're able to do that as well. And so that's $500 off that price. And so it's $19.99. I also have a whole slew of tents from our camping retreats. And so if that's something that is of interest, you know, to sleep on the ground for 4 nights and then to have access to the retreat home and the rest of the activities, that's totally within your scope if that's something that calls to you.
And also just want to make the point that if you live in Park City or in the nearby area and you don't want to spend the night out there, you also have a day price, and you can find out more about that on the website, which is wildwomentribe.net.
So we have spoken to Alejandra Lara on this show before, and I've known her for probably as long as she's lived in town. She's wonderful. And she does, again, that equine assisted learning. And I'd love to go into this a little bit more, because it was funny. I was just out in the county yesterday and talking with someone riding in my car with me about how horses are kind of scary to both of us. And we don't know why, other than their sheer size and volume, because there so many people I know have this deep bond with horses. And so can you go into that just a little bit more, what Alejandra will do?
Yeah. And I am not an expert. I've had the pleasure of hosting several workshops with her. And so I can only extract like a very small portion of what it is that she does. But she herself, like if you know her, you know, she's been in the community for years. She holds impeccable space. And I think that translates into a feeling of safety. And that's like her number one thing, creating safety for not only us as the people, but the horses as well. And so she's able to create this feeling of, you're okay. There's nothing that anyone's forcing you to do. This is all an invitation. And the horses have a deep level of trust with her. You can see how they respond to her. And so what she invites in is attuning into ourselves on a deeper level, that in our day-to-day functioning, like when we're kind of buzzing around the world on our phones, looking at schedules, we're very separated from ourselves in this deep kind of connected way. And so she invites that in, and she'll set the tone with a series of meditations that allow us to really connect to ourselves. And then using the tools from Marissa and Shamanic Twist, you know, to turn into ourselves and to really feel ourselves somatically and energetically, we kind of drop into a meditative state with the horses. And I know the first session that I've done with Alejandra in the workshop setting, it always involves us sitting in a circle. So we're actually sitting in the horse ring, and the horses each have a handler. And so safety and physical safety is very much curated. And we're sitting there and we're meditating, and she's leading us through this deep exercise of going deeper within ourselves. And then the horses are allowed to approach us. And so it's an invitation for them to actually not be dominated by the humans, you know, and it allows them to follow their guidance system and come up to someone from behind, which they don't often do when they're being led by the reins, you know? And so you get to see these relationships forming where the horses and their own innate curiosity is encouraged and celebrated, and they feel comfortable like sniffing you or maybe like touching you with their muzzles. And as you say, you know, they're huge and they're powerful, yet they're so, so gentle. And so I think to be in that setting and allow yourself to feel the kind of discomfort of having like a 600-pound animal behind you, and then to know that you're okay, you're safe, you're trusted, you know, you are safe in your body, you're safe on the earth, and you're safe with this animal who is being led by someone, or being like he has a handler, is allowed to come up to you. That's a very beautiful kind of co-creative experience to be in.
Oh, that sounds great. What do you think it is that makes women-only retreats so powerful?
I think that, well, first of all, I think women, a lot of us have had less than ideal experiences with other women because of how we're brought up and because of how we feel like there's competition or scarcity, or, oh, if she gets a promotion, then that means it's taking away from me. And so I think a lot of times we have these women, these sister wounds that we carry forth in life. And so I think having a setting where, you know, safety and like honoring where we are and checking in with our boundaries and consent, where that is already established, I think that can create a very healing container and experience for women to come together in a way where it's like, you know what, I can be vulnerable. I can learn how to communicate with other women. I can like heal these aspects that may have hurt in the past because of how we're raised and because of how we teach ourselves to interface with the world. And so I think coming together in a circle is something women have done innately for centuries. You know, it is something cultural that has spanned different cultures and different times. And so to have a modern day women's circle and a space where we can come, be ourselves, let our egos kind of take the back burner and allow vulnerabilities to come forward, it can be a really powerful way of reframing relationships with women.
I absolutely agree. Is there, I noticed it's around the fall equinox. Is that right?
Yeah, it ends on the fall equinox on the 22nd. Yeah.
So those milestones throughout the year are kind of cool. Is there anything special about choosing that time to have the retreat?
It's really funny when I choose dates with people, because it's often dictated just by availability in the calendar and, you know, what's coming up. And then it is so funny how often it'll span these kind of energetic milestones or seasonal milestones. So I would say initially it was just fall time. You know, we did it in the fall last year. It was a beautiful time of year to be in Utah and to be hiking and outside. And then it just so happens, really, that it spanned the equinox. And I actually don't believe in coincidences. So I think it's like, okay, well, there's a reason. And it's even more beautiful when it kind of comes into fruition like that, full circle. You're like, oh, and it's the equinox, seasonal change.
of course.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah, perfect.
All right, Renee, well, this sounds like a wonderful time in September, but let's have you briefly update us on, you have a summer series that you do, these Wednesday hikes. So tell us about the rest of the season.
Yeah, so we've been doing these Wednesday hikes. They are 9 to 11:30 on a different trail in Park City every Wednesday. I think we have three more, depending on when this runs, and they involve a different a different coach or facilitator and a different trail each week. And so they're drop-in, they're donation-based, and they're just a great way of getting together in the community in the morning on Wednesdays and seeing a different perspective.
Wonderful. And it's wildwomentribe.net, correct?
Yes.
Wildwomentribe.net. That's how you can find out more and sign up for the series. Any last words you wanted to share, Renee?
I am just really, really grateful to the women in the community and you guys and just the space that we're in right now, where it feels like we're calling in more of this vulnerability and more of this community collaboration and just talking about our feelings on a level that I feel like is at an all new high. You know, it feels like we are ready for this type of connection and group activation and coming together and supporting each other. So I feel like this is just more of an upward spiral that I see happening more and more in the world. And so I'm really thankful for it.
All right, Renee, thank you so much for joining us today. And I love that. That's a great positive note to end on. Well, it's all been positive.
It is.
Thank you.
Thank you too so much.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Our next guest is novelist David Robleski, who has written a new book called Familiaris. Now, if you've already finished that summer read and you're looking for a new one, here's your pick. It's the follow-up to David's New York Times number one best-selling book, The Story of Edgar Sawtelle. It's an Oprah Book Club choice. And what caught my eye and my heart was a review in the Library Journal, which says that this book, Familiaris, is seriously recommended for all readers whose hearts were first broken by Wilson Rawls' Where the Red Fern Grows, which is a book I'll never forget. David Robleski will be in Salt Lake City this Thursday, August 1st, at the King's English Bookstore. And we're so pleased that David could join us now. Welcome to The Mountain Life, David.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's really nice to have you. One of the things that I read about your book, that it was meticulously researched. And when a book is meticulously researched in its writing, it tells me that it took a long period of time in your life.
Yeah, that's true. I started on it probably in 2010, I would guess, seriously. It's taken more or less, it took about 12 years to really get it completely finished. Of course, it takes some time to get a book through publication. So that's why we're in 2024 at this point. As far as research goes, I'm a terrible, sloppy researcher. I enjoy doing it, but only until I'm not interested anymore. I can never predict when I'm going to be so interested, I have to stop myself, and when I need to make myself more interested. But I was lucky in this case because there are so many interesting events that took place during the times of this book that I was mainly faced with trying to stop researching.
Yes. Well, it is set in the Northwoods of Wisconsin in 1919. And you do open the book talking about what these various characters from history, you know, from Ernest Hemingway to, I'm blanking on some of the others, you know, we're doing at that time to kind of provide a sketch for the reader on, you know, what we might think about that period of time.
Sure. The prologue of the book ends with this, or almost ends with this paragraph that just says it's May 1919. And to me, that doesn't tell much of a story. So I wanted to say what was happening in May of 1919. Ernest Hemingway had just gotten back from Italy. He hadn't written any books yet. The poet Elizabeth Bishop was, you know, still a child. Edwin Hubble, the astronomer, was contemplating this outrageous idea that there might be more than one galaxy in the universe, and so on. So I tried to pick a set of people and moments that I could actually determine were actually happening in May of 1919. And then I embellished a little bit, of course, because I'm a novelist, so I can't stop myself. But it was my way of trying to set the scene culturally, because that was an interesting time. There was a lot of people were rethinking a lot of things at that moment. And part of what's going on in this book is it's the first of what the book refers to as the great quests that John goes on in his life. He begins the first one at that moment.
Some people say that there are century cycles, that kind of when the COVID came around and people started talking about the Spanish flu 100 years earlier. Are there any things from that period that you're seeing kind of reflected in our current culture?
It is an accident that we're recently dealing with a pandemic. Of course, the Spanish flu in that era was devastating, and actually doesn't play a role in this book. The thing I was trying to pick up on, and I'm not sure whether it applies now or not, is that was a moment where people were still interested in the idea of a sort of bohemian lifestyle. They felt it was possible to sort of make a radical change in their life, to start over somewhere and really start with a clean slate. And so what happens in the opening of the book is the main character, John Sawtelle, finds a farm that he can't afford and doesn't know why he would like to buy it, but he puts a bid in on the farm, and it's just the way he is. He makes these impulsive decisions. So my feeling is that I've met quite a number of people lately who would like to just check out of the way the world is working right now and start over somehow. So to the degree that that's true, I think it resonates.
I think that right here in Park City, we've seen a lot of that. People who maybe came to Kip Up during COVID and never left, or wanted to move to a place where there's more nature, and they want to reinvent their lives, like you're saying, you know, have a fresh slate and see where it takes them.
That's a really interesting connection. The way people's lifestyles have changed with the pandemic and working from home and being less tied to a particular location than they've been. I hadn't made that connection before, but I think it's absolutely right.
Isn't that kind of part of the fun parts about being an author, is that you write from what you want to share, and then people reflect back all this new stuff that you're like, ooh, there's a part of me that must be brilliant in there. I had no idea I was integrating all that.
You're absolutely right. The way I look at it is the real learning about the book begins after it's published, because you live inside the book, and it's not the same at all as reading a finished book. By the time I've finished the first book, Edgar, and now this one, I would look at them and I don't just see one book. I see 100 books that are slightly different from one another, and all those editorial decisions about what to put in and what to leave out are all, sometimes I can't remember honestly which version of the book got published, because there were a lot of hard decisions about what to put in, what to take out.
It's like the multiverse of writing.
Yeah, it is sort of like that. And so it's absolutely fascinating. And I have a long history being interested in how people respond to artifacts that we make. To me, it's absolutely fascinating to hear readers talk about what happened for them, because that's how I actually learn about what went out into the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so interesting how Mary Beth perceived it, because I began to think about the, you know, again, modern day, but completely upending the way that we live, and especially going off, and maybe it's this decade and, you know, that I'm living in, my age, where my friends and I talk often about going off together and kind of creating a little compound and bringing our, of course, dogs along with us. And whether it's buying that dollar house in a small town in Italy that they advertise, who knows if they're really real. Or if it's, you know, some other idyllic place, like, well, the Northwoods of Wisconsin. And that's what John Sautel and his friends do.
Why did you originally choose this location in the Northwoods of Wisconsin?
The choice of location actually goes all the way back to Edgar. And since this is the story of Edgar's grandfather and really how the farm that Edgar grew up on, how that came about, it was sort of, it was dictated by the fact that there is this other book that it connects to. But the way I picked that is I just spent a lot of time driving around in Wisconsin. I had a particular image in mind of a place, very much like the farm where I grew up, but I wanted it, somehow that seemed too ordinary. So I wanted it to be a little more exotic. And I just ran across the small town in northern Wisconsin that I just thought looked exactly the way I imagined where they would live. It's a little town called Mellon. And so I picked it, and I could have renamed it. I know that the tradition among authors is to pick a real town and then rename it.
Yeah.
But the truth is, I never thought that the first book was going to get published. So I didn't bother to rename it. And so I thought, okay, well, let's just leave it as Mellon. And so that's why it's up there. I think it's a beautiful area. To me, it seems exotic as opposed to where I grew up. But the exercise was to take the farm where I grew up, evacuate all the people who actually lived there, move it a couple of hundred miles north, and then play out a story there, because I know that place. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have to imagine a new farm. It's our farm, exaggerated for artistic effect, but it's our farm. It's 92 acres, same size as ours. The fence line is the same. The layout of the field is the same, but all different people.
And where in Wisconsin is your farm?
Where I grew up was smack in the center of Wisconsin. And of course, if you've ever looked at Wisconsin, it can be difficult to know what a center would be on a shape that odd. But I grew up outside a little town of 600 named Pittsville, Wisconsin. And and I know it's the center of Wisconsin because just outside of town, behind some farmer's barn, there is a national geological survey marker saying this is the exact, we've calculated where the exact center of Wisconsin is, and it's right here behind this person's barn.
Oh my goodness. I was wondering, and this is not because I looked at a map, but one time I rode my bicycle through Wisconsin, and I was thinking, when you say the exact center, I went to Wisconsin Rapids.
That's very close. I mean, Wisconsin Rapids is one of the two nearest good-sized towns.
Okay, beautiful, beautiful area.
Yeah, I actually grew up in Illinois, and if you take 39 straight down from Wisconsin, you land right in my family's house. And it was a farm town also, so I appreciated that so much. I was so fascinated by the fact that Oprah chose not only your first book, but this book also to share with her many fan readers. Can you just tell us a little about how that happened and how that maybe has affected the life of these books?
Well, I don't know how they make their choices, of course. That's their secret. And if I was them, I'd keep it secret too. So it's been, of course, a great thing. She's one of our premier readers in our culture. And so it's been an opportunity to introduce both of these stories to a wide range of readers. And she doesn't just, what I think is interesting, she doesn't just pick them. She sort of pioneered the idea of having a book club that sticks with the book for a month or 2 months and goes through it. That to me is incredibly valuable. To linger on a book and to have a chance to talk about it. To me, that's the one of the great joys of reading, particularly reading longer novels, of which these are both.
Yeah, the resonance is something that we don't have as often anymore. Everything seems to be speeding up, doesn't it? And so to linger on a book, like you say, and to think about it before you just go on to the next thing. It's almost like when you get to the end of a really great show that you've been watching and you don't realize that you're on the last episode, and then you feel like you've fallen off this cliff, but you want to stay with it rather than starting something new, so that we can just allow things to reverberate through our lives a little bit.
One of the things that I think is absolutely fascinating about the novel as an art form is that it becomes the second life that you live. A little bit in the same way that these long series TV shows have worked out, and they're called novelistic for a reason. I feel like my life has lost a dimension when I don't wake up in the morning, and think about both lives, the one I'm living and the one that I'm reading about, and what's going to happen, and I'm slightly worried about what's going to go on. Are things going to work out right for them? So there is really no other art form that does it the way that novels do. And I think that's the thing that makes it worth all the effort and time that it takes to write a novel, is knowing that you can create that kind of an experience for people.
That's wonderful. Well, speaking of the experience, you'll be coming here to Salt Lake City to the King's English Bookshop on Thursday, August 1st. And the event is at 6 p.m. Now, I'm imagining that you're going all around the country, stopping at small bookstores and doing this thing that is so wonderful and so time consuming, but it is part of the process. Do you expect that your audience in these small bookstores are, for example, those who loved your first book, Edgar Sawtelle, or the story of Edgar Sawtelle, or when they come to hear you speak, is it people who just, I don't know, they don't have anything else to do on a Thursday night and they love books, so they show up? Maybe they've heard of you or not.
Both happen. I'm happy to have anybody show up. There's something really kind of magical that happens in bookstores when writers come and there's a group of readers and you're surrounded by books. It's a different kind of place to talk about stories than any other place. So I enjoy it. I look forward to it. Every time it's different. There's no way to generalize, really.
Mm-hmm. You know, something I love about novels is when, you know, you talked about how some authors rename the town and then you didn't, and how much of it, I find myself constantly going down rabbit holes, looking up the places and the people who you talk about, wondering if they're real or not. And the Kissel Car Company in Hartford, Wisconsin is real. And I'm sorry, I had never heard about a Kissel car before, but that's sort of I think it's chapter one, you sort of roll it out by talking about this car company.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little more about that?
Sure. I picked, when I was writing Edgar, and I should say although these books are connected in one chronologically, the newest one takes place before the second one. They're not written in such a way that you have to have read Edgar in order to read Familiaris. But there are certain topics that get introduced in one, in Edgar, that I wanted to expand on in Familiaris. So, and one of them was, I did a little research on what kind of cars would have been around at that time. There were hundreds and hundreds of models of cars. And all those companies, all those little companies eventually got gobbled up or went out of business. And now we just have the few that we know today. But I looked at which ones were based in Wisconsin and ran across the Kissel brand, and then ran across this automotive museum, wonderful automotive museum in Hartford. and learned all about it. It so happened that Hartford is where the Kissel manufacturing plant was. And so they had all kinds of historical materials, have all kinds of actual vehicles. And so I could go there and just imagine very easily what it was like to have to go on an adventure, which this book is basically an adventure story that takes it's five different adventures in his life. But this first adventure, what did that car look like? What was it like to travel hundreds of miles in those old cars? So to me, that was just a complete boon. And I've been there many, many times over the writing of this book.
I bet a lot of more people are going to know about them after this book.
I hope so. They deserve it. It's a wonderful museum.
For those who really loved and dove in and let your first book linger in their minds, what kind of things might they feel are familiar in Familiaris, and what kind of things might feel a little more like a departure?
Well, the thing that will be familiar is the farm, because the first of these great quests is John going to the farm in the first place with his wife, Mary. And we learn about John and Mary, who were introduced in the story of Edgar Sawtelle, but just for about four pages. In fact, the first four pages of the first chapter of Edgar is the best summary of Familiaris that I've ever written. And I just happened to write it before I wrote Familiaris. So in a way, the entire arc of John's life has already been described in the first book, but it's really the sense of place that will seem familiar. What won't seem familiar is the people, because this is a story of a man and a woman and their love story that covers 40 years, but also two of their closest friends and how they all change over time. And those people were not mentioned at all in the story of Edgar Sawtelle because I didn't know about them at the time. It was part of my process of discovery as I wrote.
And know about them from the position of like they didn't exist yet or hadn't kind of discovered them? How does that work for you?
They didn't exist in my imagination. I knew that John and Mary would be moving to this place and that they were going to take some friends along. And that it was at first, the story was modeled a bit on the sort of bohemian lifestyle experiments that people were doing around that time. So I knew that they were going to go but I didn't know who the people were. So as I wrote, those people would do things and then they would do other things. And that's how I learned about them. I didn't start with a character biography or a fully imagined person. I let them define themselves by how they behaved. So for instance, one of John's closest friends is a fellow that is just called Elbow. And as it turned out, Elbow hardly ever speaks. He's one of those very quiet, ultra competent people who just has so many talents that you wouldn't guess it. But he does not, he's not a talkative person. And I didn't know that about him until I started writing. His other friend, the other friend that comes along is a man named Frank Eckling, who I was surprised to discover hates John. They used to be really good friends, but now hates him and decides to come along specifically to watch him fail at this endeavor. And I didn't know that either until I got to the point where they started talking. Yeah. So, I mean, that's just the fun of writing. If you knew everything ahead of time, you wouldn't write a novel because it's just too much work.
Yeah. Well, David, we've run out of time here, but people can visit you at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City at 6 p.m. on Thursday, August 1st. And by means of wrapping up this interview, one thing that you treat a lot in your book, which goes back to what I said in the intro about where the red fern grows, that was about love for a dog and many dogs in your book. And that's something that appeals to us here in Park City. We love our dogs. And of course, many people around the world love their dogs, but why the canine connection?
It's interesting. I completely forgot to mention that. Well, first of all, in the story of Edgar Sawtelle, they are raising and training this fictional extraordinary breed of dogs. So I really wanted to do two things in this book. I wanted to understand who this character John Sawtelle was, because he kept popping up while I was writing the story of Edgar Sawtelle. But I also wanted to talk about the origin of these dogs, hence the title of the book. We get to see the dogs that came with them to this farm and who they eventually, over the course of 40 years, end up creating this extraordinary breed of dogs.
Aha. Familiaris is the name of the book, and our guest is David Robleski. David, thank you so much for joining us on the Mountain Lake, and best of luck with this book. It's beautiful.
Thanks very much. It was a delight to be here. Looking forward to coming.
You've been listening to The Mountain Life on KPCW Park City. If you missed part of today's show or would like to share it, you can access it along with all past shows on our website, kpcw.org. Also, did you know we have a podcast? Please listen or subscribe wherever you get your podcast.